bidding and the use of technology for efficiency and access.
And Ms. Cleveland, could you just tell us what slide number is that so we can all find it in our booklet?
Now we're on slide 80.
80?
Yep.
Okay. Very good.
So the provider peer grouping program was originally passed as part of the 2008 health care reform bill, and then legislation was passed last year that refined this still developing program. The legislation tasked the health department with developing this first-in-the-nation statewide provider peer grouping system, and it's meant to be a tool that would create transparent pricing and encourage provider innovation, collaboration for effective or cost-effectiveness and high-quality care, and also as a tool for consumers to compare healthcare costs and quality among providers, which would the ones that are being kind of grouped or ranked are hospitals and clinics. The original legislation included statutory deadlines, and as those deadlines approached last year, it became clear that more work needed to be done in crafting the system. There are limited models to look to in developing this kind of system, and it involves complicated relative comparisons of providers with a lot of different variables. So last session's legislation that passed modified the program to remove those date certain deadlines from statute, provide a more formal process for providers to review the data that is being used to group them, and also to require certain standards that must be met before any patients or provider-specific information can be released to the public. The certified the healthcare homes program was also part of the 2008 healthcare reform bill, and it requires that healthcare homes be certified by the Department of Health. That's under Chapter 62U. In order to be certified, a clinic has to meet specified standards that relate to providing patient-centered care. Those include providing coordination of primary care and other services, providing a care coordinator, and also developing care plans for patients with complex or chronic medical conditions. As of December 2012, there were 214 clinics in the state that are certified as healthcare homes. And also the MA program provides payments for healthcare homes for the care coordination services that are provided to persons with complex or chronic medical conditions. And then the state is also participating in a multi-payer advanced primary care practice demonstration project, which one aspect of that is that Medicare, the federal program, can reimburse certified healthcare homes for care coordination patient payment services that are provided to its beneficiaries.
The legislature has also authorized various demonstration projects.
I'm sorry, could you?
Oh, I'm sorry.
For the reference.
Randy Chun with House Research.
Thank you, Mr. Chun.
The legislature has authorized various demonstration projects to evaluate and expand new methods of paying healthcare providers. And the state has also applied for and received various federal grants to do this. And so this slide lists some of the most recent initiatives. The general goal of payment reform is to move away from the traditional fee-for-service system under which provider payments would increase as a provider, you know, provides more services. The various payment reform approaches would replace this with a fixed payment for a set of services, such as an episode of care, or for a wider range of services, such as total cost of care. And this payment is often risk adjusted, and sometimes contingent upon the provider meeting certain quality standards. So it's hoped that these new payment methods give providers a financial incentive to provide care, you know, more efficiently and provide high-quality care. Under managed care competitive bidding, DHS has implemented a competitive bidding approach to deliver services through prepaid health plans to MA and Minnesota Care enrollees in the 7-county metro area who are families and children. DHS has traditionally negotiated rates with HMOs and county-based purchasing plans, and they've usually based this on past expenditures, utilization trends, and other factors. And all plans that would agree to this negotiated rate, which is kind of like the same base rate for each plan, can then serve managed care enrollees within each, you know, county or county group. What competitive bidding does, it allows the state to select plans based on the lowest bid or other criteria. So competitive bidding operates as a demonstration project during calendar years 2012 and 2013, and enrollees have to have a choice of at least two plans. And then the 2012 legislature authorized DHS to continue competitive bidding for calendar year 2014 and subsequent years.
Mr. Tun, if I could just stop you there for a second, because I just want, even though, you know, this is occupying one slide, I just want to sort of flag it for members, because we're talking about when we're, I hope that members are who are newer to the committee are kind of following this, because when we're talking about managed care competitive bidding, we're talking about our MA program and how we actually deliver the care to our people who are on our public programs. And so a lot of this is being done through managed care plans that contract with the state to provide the care for us. And then the decisions kind of within what happens with their care, what they can get, who they can go to, depend upon the plan that they are then enrolled in. So, Mr. Chun, if I say anything that's not correct, I hope you'll correct me. And so this is a lot of our public dollar, and maybe Mr. Chun could tell us, well, we heard this morning in the Finance Committee, I know not all of you are on it, but we heard about what a huge piece of our budget this is, and then managed care and this capitated rate that we're paying to the managed care plans for our public programs is a very, very large piece of our budget. So maybe Mr. Chun can tell us how much that is if he has the number. But I just want to flag that for you, because I know policy and finance, you know, in many places they're very, very closely related, and this is one. So,
yeah. Madam Chair, regarding that number, this is just the figure that was on the DHS website. So it's $3.7 billion in spending for fiscal year 2012 for managed care.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question. Did you say, is it up to the enrollee or is it up to DHS to choose the policy once the bids come in? Who chooses what plan they go with?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, under the competitive bidding process, DHS would choose the plan, so not all plans, presumably in each county that would want to serve that county, are accepted. Enrollees would then have a choice of two plans, and then the enrollee could then choose between the two plans that were accepted.
Representative Mack, does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Representative Albright.
No, I'm sure. On slide number 82. The point made about 9 healthcare delivery systems, if it's possible to identify who they are, just from a size standpoint, I'd be curious. Sure. In terms of if they're metropolitan or greater Minnesota, but also in that same bullet point, talks about the arrangement, the risk gain sharing arrangements that are provided. Could you expound on that as well? I'm just curious in terms of what the term of this project is, okay, as well as when the results from the project will be known to us.
Okay.
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I guess as of December, DHS was still negotiating the final contracts with these 9 delivery systems. I don't have their names with me now. They are on the DHS, you know, website. I think there were some responses to RFPs that are on there, but the eventual goal of this delivery system project is to serve about 150,000 state program enrollees, and it's a 3-year duration for the demonstration project. And again, I don't have the details of the risk gain sharing. I think a lot of that will depend upon, or I think more information will be forthcoming from the department once the contracts are finalized. But again, the risk and gain is intended to give providers, you know, some financial incentive to be efficient. They'd share in some gains. At the same time, you know, they also could be responsible for loss if there's some overspending.
No follow-up, Representative Albright? Okay. All right. Other questions? All right. Please continue, Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair and members,
Ms. Cleveland.
Another aspect of ensuring value for healthcare dollars is the use of technology to improve efficiency and access. Part of that is the electronic health records. There's a statutory mandate as of January 1st, 2015. All hospitals and healthcare providers are to have an interoperable electronic health record system within their hospital system or their clinical practice setting. And the health information exchange refers to a system for transmission of this e-health information between providers or provider organizations, so to ensure that it's sent in a uniformly accepted way that meets specified standards that are meant to ensure and protect the data and also the privacy of the patients. The health department set the uniform standards. They're in statute and rule, and they're consistent with national standards for interoperability of these e-health systems. The department also provides some technical assistance, and there's some loan funding available for providers that are getting these systems in place. The department also has statutory authority to enforce the requirements applicable under the health information exchange provisions and statute. Hey, I just met you.
That is my favorite.
Madam Chair, the next approach to the new use of technology, which maybe is appropriate for that, is the health insurance exchange, which I think many of you have heard about at various recent meetings. The Federal Affordable Care Act requires states, or the federal government if states do not act, to establish a health insurance exchange for the individual and small employer markets to be operational January 1 of 2014. And it's intended to facilitate the selection and purchase of health coverage by individuals and small employers, providing comparative information on plans, allowing some comparison on what each plan would cost the enrollee after you take into account some of the exchange subsidies. So it's supposed to be a common entry point to apply for both private sector and exchange coverage, as well as coverage from Medicaid and other public health care programs. There's to be a standard streamlined application. The exchange would determine or assess eligibility for various types of coverage. There'd be procedures to share information across agencies, so enrollees wouldn't need to keep, submitting information. Minnesota's exchange proposal received conditional approval from the federal government on December 20th of 2012. And just to get some sense of what other states are doing, as of January 4th of 2013, and this is information from the Kaiser Foundation, the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, 19 states had elected a state-based exchange, including Minnesota. Seven had chosen a partnership exchange, which would be a partnership between the state and the federal government. And 25, I guess, will default to a federally run exchange.
And members, you're going to hear an awful lot more about this. We are going to be hearing a bill on this in probably a couple of weeks, and this is going to be one of the big topics of the session. So, just heads up on that.
Madam Ms. Chair, Cleveland. Members, the next goal that we are discussing is addressing access to care issues. The part of that is ensuring or trying to ensure that there are providers available, and that is the workforce development piece. There has been broad agreement that the state is facing a healthcare workforce shortage across a number of professions, geographical areas of the state, and also in certain patient populations. Part of the issue is that the state is getting older, and so is its workforce. And the other part is related to practice choices of medical students and students of other healthcare professions. The state has a couple of programs that are meant to help influence these choices for the students by providing loan forgiveness for professionals that commit to practicing in certain high-need areas of the state. Also, there's the Medical Education and Research Costs Fund, which is called MERC. And it was created by the legislature in the late 1990s to help offset the lost patient care revenue of teaching facilities, and also to ensure that continued excellence in the healthcare research in Minnesota. The MERC program is a more than $60 million program that uses both state and federal money to provide incentive and support to hospitals and clinics in order to train healthcare professionals. And the distribution formula is set in statute. It was last changed substantially in 2007. And it is because of the use of federal dollars, it needs to be approved by CMS or risk losing that share, which at this point is half, I think. Our office put together a publication on the funding mechanisms, which is a bit, the funding mechanisms are a bit convoluted, so if you're interested, that sets it out. It's available online, or you can come see me and I can get it to you.
Madam Chair, the
Mr. Chun.
Next topic would be various Affordable Care Act initiatives to expand coverage for low-income persons or to provide subsidies. These three are, first of all, subsidies provided through the health insurance exchange, second, the optional Medicaid expansion, third, the optional basic health care program. And again, you know, these are options that you've heard about, you know, especially at the meeting, committee meeting last night. I'll still go over these slides since I think this presentation provides a little more detail, at least, you know, some aspects of those programs. So starting first with the subsidies through the exchange, the federal government will provide premium tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies for persons with low to moderate incomes to purchase coverage through the exchange. Again, the exchange is operational January 1st of 2014. In order to be eligible for the subsidies, the person must first meet the general requirements for exchange coverage, and these are to be a citizen or legal non-citizen and not incarcerated. And there's an error on this slide. This reference to filing a tax return should be deleted from that line. Filing a tax return or being part of a tax filing unit is actually a requirement for receiving a subsidy through the exchange and not just, you know, generally obtaining exchange
coverage. Mr. Chun, if you could just give us the number of the slides
sure.
You go here. I think it's a little hard to follow.
Okay. This is slide 90. So in the first bullet, there's a reference after not incarcerated to filing a tax return, and that was put there in error, so that should be crossed out, and that is just more of a requirement for exchange, for obtaining a subsidy and not just entering the exchange generally. The other criteria would be that the income must not exceed 400% of the federal poverty guidelines, and the individual must not be covered by Medicaid, Medicare, employer coverage, except there's an exception if this coverage is unaffordable or it provides less than 60% actuarial value, and they also can't have other specified coverage. For covered services, the policies must cover essential health benefits as defined by the Affordable Care Act. The ACA requires essential health benefits to be similar to a typical employer plan, and the actual law also requires 10 broad categories of benefits to be covered. Federal guidance issued, I guess after the law, basically provides that essential health benefits for the years 2014 and 2015 be defined by a benchmark plan that's selected by each state. And then if a state, you know, doesn't affirmatively choose an option, the default essential health benefits would be the largest plan in the small group market. So in Minnesota, this would be a Health Partners product. Minnesota did not choose a benchmark option, so this is the default option that applies in this state. Moving now to premiums and tax credits. The enrollee is responsible for the premiums of whatever policy they choose for the exchange, but they may be eligible for premium tax credits. And these tax credits may pay all or just a portion of the premiums of the policy selected. It depends on, you know, what plan they choose. Premium tax credits are the intent of the premium tax credits is to limit premium payments that an enrollee pays to a specified percentage of income, and it's based on the cost of what the exchange or the ACA sets up as the second lowest cost silver plan, and I'll go over that in a little more detail. But the effect of this is that this would limit enrollee premium costs to 2% of income for persons with incomes at 100% of poverty, and there's sort of a sliding scale, and then it would be 9.5% of income at 400% of the federal poverty guidelines. Now, the ACA establishes or provides, I guess, cost-sharing subsidies. The ACA establishes cost-sharing based on four plans that have different actuarial values. And the actuarial value is the percentage of medical expenses that is, you know, paid for on average by a health insurance product. So this is expressed in terms of four types of metals, which you've probably heard about. Bronze, which has 60% actuarial value, so it means that the enrollee pays 40% of expenses on average and the plan pays 60%. Silver is a 70% actuarial value, gold 80%, platinum 90% actuarial value. And I guess one feature of the ACA is that these cost-sharing subsidies are available only for persons purchasing plans at the silver level only. And the effect of these cost-sharing subsidies is to reduce out-of-pocket maximums and also sometimes reduce other cost-sharing. Regarding financing, the federal government pays the full cost of the premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. Move now to the Medicaid expansion. This is a state option to cover adults without children and other groups with incomes up to 133% of poverty. And, you know, again, there's a 5% standard disregard that's been mentioned, so you could also say it's 138% if you include the disregard. And this could begin on January 1st of 2014 if a state elects to do this. I think it's also been mentioned that Minnesota, through early Medicaid expansion, already covers adults in this group with incomes up to 75% of the federal poverty guidelines.
Mr. Chun, if you could just to slow you down a little bit here, I think this term income disregard is a bit of jargon for some of us, and maybe you could just give us a little moment about what that means.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, basically an income disregard is used when you calculate whether or not, you know, a person satisfies the program's income limit. So you could disregard certain types of income, you know, certain perhaps public benefit income, certain tax return income could be disregarded. So you subtract that from your income, and then your net income amount after these disregards is then compared to a program's income standard.
There's a question from Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chun, the second part of that slide, right now we're paying 50% of the cost of these people up to 75% of poverty. Is there a maintenance of effort requirement, or does that go completely away and the feds will pay the 100%?
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, there's no maintenance of effort requirement for states that elect the early expansion. So once the state, you know, opts to go up to 133, they would get a full 100% match for the first 3 years for the group from, you know, basically 1% of income to 133% of income.
Okay, and if members didn't totally follow that, it's okay, because there'll be a lot of options, opportunities to circle back to that. Okay, Mr. Chun, if you would continue, and if you could remember to let us know what slide you're on.
We are now on slide 96. Yeah. This is dealing with eligibility for the Medicaid expansion. So the income limit again is 133% or 138% with the disregard of the poverty guidelines. Modified adjusted gross income is what is used. I think that was discussed yesterday. There's no asset limit, and a person must not be elderly, pregnant, eligible for or enrolled in Medicare, and also not otherwise eligible for Medicaid under an existing group, such as, you know, a person with disabilities who's, you know, covered now in the current Minnesota care standards. And other than that, all other state Medicaid program criteria apply. Moving now to covered services, the next slide.
Let me just stop you again there, okay. Mr. Chun. There's a question over here. Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. In 2014, when Minnesota is, when this program comes in with the feds paying 100% for the first 3 years, what kind of savings will that be for the state? Do you have any estimates?
Madam Chair, that's something that I've talked about with House fiscal staff and they've talked about with state agency staff. I think at this point we're still working on trying to get good numbers on that, so I don't have anything for you right now.
Yeah, Representative Benson, I'm sure that's going to be a big topic as well. And if you can kind of hold that question, and I think House fiscal staff, too, would probably be able to help you more with that. But we're going to get into that, I think, quite deeply, if not in this committee, then in the other one. Are you also in finance? Okay.
But Madam Chair.
We'll make sure you get options for that. Representative Aiden.
I think just the back of the envelope number, it's somewhere around $200 million for the biennium if we do the expansion in savings, net federal share to Minnesota.
Other questions? Okay, and I just wanted to clarify on slide 96, Mr. Chun, when you're talking about these people who are not part of the expansion group, I just want to make sure members understand that doesn't mean they're not eligible for Medicaid, mm-hmm. right? When you're talking about the expansion group, you're talking about who will the feds pay for when we expand fully. Right, not who will be
eligible. Madam Chair, that's correct. It's, okay. it's discussion of that term is usually tied to who receives this enhanced federal match, not the regular 50% Medicaid
right.
match.
Representative Huntley,
Madam Chair and Mr. Chun, just something I've forgotten. The where it says disabled, is that our determination of who's disabled, or does it require the federal approval of that?
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that would be based on the state's or Minnesota's current Medicaid criteria. And what Minnesota does is to determine someone as being disabled, generally they need to meet the Social Security standards of disability.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Chun.
Representative Huntley.
Does that mean we have to wait till they're approved for SSI?
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, basically the disabled here are, I think this slide is just saying that, the ACA doesn't include in this newly eligible group persons who under, a state's current law, such, basically our disability criteria, would not qualify. So nothing would change about how eligibility is determined for someone who's disabled. So yes, in that sense, a person would need to apply and wait. If that's their only means of becoming eligible for MA, they'd have to wait for the, a Social Security disability determination.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, the reason I asked that question is it can take 3 or 4 years to go through the Social Security Administration to get approval, and you usually have to hire a lawyer to carry your case, so it can be a long, long time before the feds say, oh yeah, you're disabled, even though it's obvious at the beginning.
And Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I think maybe that detail is something that can be pursued later, but there's been some discussion of people who, technically don't at this point meet the SSI disability standard to enter Medicaid through this early expansion group. But I think maybe that's something that the department staff could maybe elaborate on more.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Chun or Ms. Cleveland, go ahead.
Madam Chair, we're now on slide 97. This is covered services under the Medicaid expansion. These services can be different from or less generous than a state's regular Medicaid benefit set. It tends to be based on benchmark or benchmark equivalent coverage. Again, coverage tied to specific plans that are out there in the real world. There's also an option of secretary-approved coverage, which could be a state's regular MA benefit set. The benefit set must cover essential health benefits as defined in the Affordable Care Act, and there are also some other requirements related to coverage of specific services. Now moving to the next slide, slide 98, premiums and cost sharing. There are no enrollee premiums for coverage. Enrollee cost sharing would be subject to the requirements of the Medicaid program, which you went over yesterday, which tend to be, you know, fairly nominal cost sharing. The financing for the Medicaid expansion, the federal government provides an enhanced federal match for adults without children and other newly eligible groups. It's a 100% match for the first 3 years, 2014 through 2016. Then 2017, it's a 95% match. 2018, 94% match. 2019, a 93% match. And then a 90% match for 2020 and the following years. Madam Chair, now move to the third program. This is the basic health program. This is an optional program that allows states to cover persons with incomes greater than 133 but not exceeding 200% of the poverty guidelines. And the intent of this program is to sort of serve as a transition between Medicaid coverage and coverage that could be subsidized through the exchange. There's a, you know, possibility of providing coverage at a lower cost to the enrollee or possibly providing additional benefits than would be the case under the exchange. Move to slide 101, which is eligibility. The eligibility criteria are as follows. Again, income greater than 133 but not exceeding 200% of the poverty guidelines. There's no asset tests. You must be a citizen or legal non-citizen. You cannot be covered by Medicaid, Medicare, employer coverage unless this coverage is unaffordable. And you also can't be covered by other health policies that are mentioned in the specific act. And you have to be younger than age 65. Covered services, the basic health program must provide at least essential health benefits, again, as defined by the Affordable Care Act. The medical loss ratio must be 85% or higher.
And Mr. Chun, yes. If you could just take a second to tell everybody what the medical loss ratio is, because this is a very technical term, but one that people are going to be hearing a lot, I think, this year, and worth knowing what it is.
Madam Chair, the loss ratio is basically the amount that a policy or product pays out for health care. And I think it's usually distinguished from, you know, administrative costs. So the ACA has some loss ratios. For example, 85% for large group policies, 80% for small group and individual policies.
Question from Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chun, who defines unless coverage is unaffordable in 101, and where is that guideline? How do we figure that out?
Mr. Chun.
Let's see.
It's in slide 101.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, the definition of unaffordable is in the actual Affordable Care Act, and I think in this case coverage is determined by the Act or to be unaffordable if the enrollee pays more than 8% of income.
Thank you.
8%?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about the basic health program and what we know from the feds will be coming forward. Do we have decent language on what to expect for that, or when will we be seeing some of that, and just maybe what the timeline is or what's kind of expected? And maybe that's more of a question for you.
Well, I'll let Mr. Chun answer, but just to say that's a really big question out there. So thank you for bringing that up, Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Rep. Schumacher, that I think was a question that was raised in some other committee meetings as well. And the Department of Federal Relations staff basically said that they're waiting for additional guidance from the state for this basic health plan. And they had mentioned that they had, or the commissioner had met with federal staff and had basically told CMS that they need the information by February in time for the state to put together a budget plan.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative, there will be a bill introduced shortly, sponsored by Representative Murphy and Senator Lori that will deal with this, but it's, you know, who knows how it's going to end up, because they'll have to wait for those federal changes so we really know what should be in the bill. But it will be introduced pretty quick.
Representative Mack.
Two quick questions, Madam Chair. One, is that the same for the essential health benefits, or is that available, what those benefits are? And my other question is, what happens if that information isn't to us by February? What happens then?
Mr. Chung.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, for your first question regarding essential health benefits, I think on a previous slide was mentioned that the state did not affirmatively choose one of the benchmark options set out by the federal government for what your essential health benefits are. The default, if a state does not make that choice, is one of the larger, I think it's the largest plan in the small employer market, which is a Health Partners product. And, you know, I guess we'll need, you know, further details on some of this from the federal government. And I guess the question of what happens if we don't receive this information, I guess I don't know. I mean, the state could either act and try to reach some agreement with the federal government for approval after the fact, but I think it's just something that the state needs to work out with the federal government. And again, I think federal relations staff at DHS, you know, might be able to provide more information what their strategies would be.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, I think some of the issue isn't as much what can we do with this population, but will we have federal participation in paying for it? So some of this really is up to us. If we don't get the guidance that we need, we're kind of flying solo in terms of the financing. But, you know, we, of course, retain the ability to give people more in a lot of cases, but I think this question might be better. Hopefully, we'll have an opportunity to direct this to Commissioner Jessen, because I think that would probably be, she'd be in a better position to answer, I think. But yeah, we're all frustrated with the uncertainty and waiting to see what happens with this. Representative Franson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chun, could you please just explain here the difference between the federal exchange and the state exchange? A couple questions here. So a state exchange, I'm being told we're going to be able to design it how Minnesota sees fit. And if that's the case, why is there so much concern over what the feds have to say about the state-run exchange? And then also, what part, if we do design our own exchange, what part of the federal law does Minnesota get to ignore?
Madam Chair, Mr. Franson, and first of all, I should just say that I'm not the analyst in the House Research Department with the most knowledge about the exchange, so that's a caveat. The way the ACA is structured is that it basically states in the law that the federal government must approve, you know, a state plan for an exchange, and the ACA sets out various criteria for what an exchange must do. You know, there has to be a hotline, you have to have streamlined applications, you know, some other general criteria. I think there's been some federal guidance on that as well. So that's, I guess, why the state has submitted a preliminary plan to get this federal approval. And there, regarding the federal exchange, there isn't really, as far as I know, at least fairly recently, there wasn't much information on what specific, how specifically the federal exchange would operate. But I'm also not the analyst in the best position to know the latest developments.
Representative France.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And then I think the second part of my question is, and maybe you touched on it, but I didn't hear it, what part of the federal law does Minnesota not have to follow?
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I think generally Minnesota follows the full ACA law related to the exchange. And I say generally because the federal law, you know, puts out some general criteria. What I'm not sure about is, and I can check on this with the proper people, is in the federal guidance that has come out to states after the actual law, whether there are certain requirements that maybe states are exempted from if they set up a state exchange. But I'm not sure of the answer to that question.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, I can give just 2 points in there that where we have some flexibility. One is if it's a federal exchange, then we have really no control over the board that runs it. Secondly, in the federal law, if it's the federal exchange, they will charge 3.5% of the cost of the premium to run the exchange. And the estimates that we're getting from our two consultants in Boston, Gruber, who did the predictions on Romney Care, and it was within 1%. We've hired him, and he thinks that we can run the exchange at 2.5%. So there's a close to a third difference in the price if we do it ourselves.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Okay, I think we can proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, we're on slide 103, dealing with premiums and cost sharing for the basic health program. Premiums under the basic health plan basically can't exceed what the enrollee would pay had the enrollee obtained subsidized coverage through the exchange. Cost sharing can't exceed for persons with incomes greater than 133 but not exceeding 150% of the poverty guidelines. It can't exceed 90% actuarial value, meaning a 10% enrollee cost sharing. For enrollees with incomes greater than 150% of the poverty guidelines, cost sharing can't exceed more than 20% of the cost of the care. Now move on to financing for the basic health program. States that choose to operate a basic health plan will receive from the federal government 95% of the value of the premium tax credits and cost sharing reductions that would otherwise be provided had the individuals been enrolled in the health insurance exchange.
Madam Chair and members, this moves us on to our last point. The goal that we identified is the role of the committee in ensuring safety and quality. So we'll go through each of these topics in a little bit more detail, the provider and health plan regulation, public health, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and birth certificates and death records. And to that last point, I just wanted to note here that for the committee that the health department has an office of the registrar, and that's where the birth records and death records are held, and it's under the purview of this committee, and that's all that I was going to say about that. So part of ensuring safety and quality of care for the population is licensing and regulation of a variety of facilities, healthcare providers, and other professions. The health department regulates a wide variety of facilities, hospitals and nursing homes, to hotels and youth camps. Not all of these facilities provide health services to clients, but many of them do. So hospitals and outpatient surgical centers are licensed and inspected by the health department. All the hospitals in the state are CMS certified to accept Medicare and Medicaid patients for reimbursement. And so there are a number of state and federal regulations that hospitals must comply with. Nursing homes are licensed and regulated by the state and are also certified by CMS to participate in the state's MA program. They provide nursing and related medical services to the elderly and physically disabled patients. The facilities are regulated by the health department, to the extent the services are reimbursed under MA, those services are regulated by DHS. Assisted living settings in the state have a lot of flexibility in how they're structured and how they provide services. In Minnesota, there's no assisted living license. However, facilities that hold themselves out as assisted living must meet minimum requirements that are set out in statute in Chapter 144G. And the assisted living providers are registered at the health department, and they offer some level of home care services, and those services are licensed also. The health department also regulates funeral homes and mortuary science. Mortuary science is the practice of preparing dead human bodies for final disposition and also providing funeral services, so that is something that's under the purview of this committee. And I also wanted to point out, too, we have another publication on kind of setting out the differences in all the facility regulation between the health department and human services, if that's helpful to you. Also, the health plan companies, health maintenance organizations, and county plan purchasing plans are, county-based purchasing plans are regulated by the health department. They regulate the quality of care provisions by the plan and contract, the health department contracts with the Department of Commerce for oversight of financial solvency concerns.
Madam Chair and members, Lynn Aves from the House Research. I'm going to cover slides 108 and 109. Mm-hmm. The Department of Human Services Licensing Division regulates residential and non-residential programs for children and adults. And at the end of last year, approximately 23,000 programs held DHS licenses. Certain licensing functions are delegated to the counties, as well as to some private agencies who perform licensing functions related to child placement and child foster care. DHS also conducts background studies. Last year, they conducted 267,000 background studies on individuals who are involved and have any contact with DHS, MDH, licensed programs for children licensed by the Department of Corrections, and for personal care provider organizations. The licensing program also conducts investigations when there are allegations of abuse or neglect of a child or a vulnerable adult served by a licensed program. They also investigate allegations of licensing violations. Health-related professionals are also regulated. Minnesota statutes provide that no occupation can be regulated by the state unless regulation is needed to provide for the safety and well-being of Minnesotans. The health-related occupations are regulated by either the Department of Health or one of the 16 health-related licensing boards. Some health-related licensing boards regulate more than one profession. For example, the Board of Medical Practice regulates physicians, acupuncturists, naturopathic doctors, traditional midwives, respiratory therapists, physician assistants. It depends on the board.
Another aspect of ensuring safety and quality that's, sorry, Madam Chair, that's under this committee's jurisdiction is public health. A well-known Institute of Medicine report from the 1980s defined public health as what we as a society do to collectively assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. And Minnesota's public health system is built on a partnership with the state, Department of Health, local public health agencies, tribal governments, and other entities. The state's Department of Health is the lead agency and is responsible for protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of Minnesotans. I included this slide, even though this is a policy committee, just to kind of give you the idea that roughly half of the budget for health department activities are federal, and not all of these are like matching dollars. Some of the programs are fully funded by the feds that the health department does. And then the other half is state money, and it would be some general fund money. There's money from fees collected by regulated entities. There's some legacy money for drinking water programs, a relatively small amount of health care access money for the health reform programs, and then there's cigarette tax revenue that goes to the Merck Medical Education Program. And I just included this because it can be helpful to keep in mind the funding sources as you're considering possible changes to existing programs.
Representative Huntley.
I
think I know what you're going to say.
Madam Chair and members, this sort of came up in the previous, in my meeting earlier, but that federal thing for this almost, well, a big chunk of that federal money would be gone if it's sequestered. Unlike the Department of Human Services, where most of their programs have to be continued. So if we get into sequestered, there's going to be some huge problems in the Department of Health.
Representative Boonhagen.
So, Representative Hudley, are you suggesting we spend time in prayer between now and March 1st?
Representative Huntley, you want to respond?
We should pray every day.
We're in agreement.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Huntley. I think it's about 8% that they were talking about. That's their, on the grants that could be cut, that's, they're looking at in that range, which would, some of those are pretty interesting things they do with public health and some of the pretty important programs. And so that, you know, they were talking about this last year as they were facing it. We mentioned it, I think, at the hearing we had in December. And so it may fall under your watch to figure out some way to adjust their duties. And I hope that the feds let us be flexible with the money that's left. I'm not confident that would be something we could ask them for.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And I thought Representative Huntley was also going to mention the relative sizes of the two departments, because here where we're looking at the $1.08 billion budget of the Department of Health, all funds budget, and the Department of Human Services, is many times larger than that in terms of employees and total budget, and I don't know how many times larger, but we're talking about orders of magnitude, right? Or, well, perhaps that's an exaggeration, but a lot bigger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if you look at the general fund dollars, you can't even compare the two.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, just to follow up there, sometimes with the people that are funded fully by federal money, they come to our hearing and go, nah, we're federal. Now they're like, oh, no, we're federal. So it's, sequestration builds humility, I think, too, Madam Chair.
Well, Representative Abler, I've just never heard that, nah, but I'll take your word for it. Okay, who are we speaking with now? Ms. Cleveland.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, we're on slide 111 now. And so this slide just gives you the wide variety of public health programs that fall under this committee's jurisdiction. The committee might consider things related to environmental health, disease control and prevention, community and family health, or infectious disease control and prevention. We're not going to go through every public health program, but I will mention a few programs in each of these areas just to give you kind of a sense of what types of programs and issues might come up before the committee. And also, of course, if members are interested in certain public health issues, you can come talk to me. I'm happy to meet with you and discuss your ideas or concerns. So the environmental health programs include things like regulation and protection of indoor air quality, such as the enforcing the Freedom to Breathe Act, which is our statewide smoking ban. It passed, I think, in 2007. And monitoring blood lead levels in children and the lead abatement programs, and also things like radiation regulation, regulation of the x-ray equipment. It also includes drinking water protection and well maintenance, well management programs. And the environmental health programs are also the food safety programs, which is the food, beverage, and lodging establishments and enforcement of the food code. Also the I just have a note here that we have an overview which agency does which, because the Department of Ag also is responsible for some of the food safety programs. Infectious disease control and prevention programs include things related to reporting and investigating foodborne illness outbreaks, providing vaccine information and immunization statistics, and providing STD and HIV statistics and reporting. Also, the Health Department has an Office of Emergency Preparedness, and they work to prepare the state with local public health to plan for and respond to environmental disasters and public health emergencies. So those types of things are under the jurisdiction of this committee, too. programs related to community and family health include things like maternal health programs, which some of them are related to collection, analysis, and reporting of health data, and for certain maternal and child health populations. And then the family home visiting programs, which are funded through the federal TANF dollars. And this is programs that work with local public health to provide a variety of services and support to certain at-risk families. There's grant programs aimed at decreasing teen pregnancy rates and STIs among certain vulnerable populations. And also there's grants for family planning services and the positive alternatives to abortion grants. Also, the state has newborn screening programs, which are public health programs that through which all infants born in the state are screened for a variety of disorders, including hearing loss. These programs use genetic information, which is a heel prick for a blood spot, and then they can test for more than 50 disorders and then also hearing loss. And there's been some recent changes to the law in this area, and there's another publication, if you're interested, that cuts some of those out. There are a variety of public health programs that are related or aimed at preventing and reducing the prevalence of chronic disease. And there's the cancer programs, which includes the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. That's a statewide registry that collects demographic and diagnostic treatment information for Minnesota residents that are diagnosed with cancer. Also, the health department has disease control or heart disease and stroke prevention programs, diabetes and asthma programs, and these are all programs that collect data, they analyze it, then and reporting to the public on and trying to reduce the prevalence of these chronic conditions. The state also has a public health program focused on eliminating health disparities.
Ms. Cleveland, sorry. Excuse me, we've got a question from Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that the EPA has come out with some recent studies that show an extremely more cardiac and pulmonary problems from PM2.5s. And so if the health department has this, and I know they have statistics on the rate of asthma in children in high pollution areas and non, what does the health department do as far as getting pollution out of those areas? Do they just punt on it and say, we're not doing that, or just what happens?
Madam Chair.
In other words, if they're supposed to promote health, what are they doing in that area, sure, to promote health?
Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, I'm not familiar with the PM2.5 program of the EPA, so I don't know about that. But the health department does have an asthma program. Some of it is funded through the feds, and I can get back to you on what if anything it does related to pollution control. I think some of it is aimed at indoor environments, but I would have to get back to you on the details of that.
Thank you. I think you can continue.
So, Madam Chair, members, there's also the Eliminating Health Disparities Program, which is a grant program that works with minority communities around the state to address health disparities through a variety of minority and multicultural health projects. And then the SHIP program, Statewide Health Improvement Program, was also part of the 2008 health care reform, and it was designed as a statewide program to initiate and support local wellness programs in communities, schools, work sites, and healthcare settings. And the goals set out in statute for that program are to reduce obesity rates in the state and to reduce tobacco use.
Oh, we have a question. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the SHIP program, did we cut that last session?
It's gone.
It's gone? Okay. I'm sorry. Because I had that working well in Faribault, but must not have it anymore.
Ms. Cleveland, do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, the funding for that has been cut, and I think it's down to nothing. The program still exists as far as the structure for it. It would just be a matter of whether or not it's going to be funded.
Madam Chair?
Representative Abler and then Hundley.
I thought we did some 15 or 10 million on that. It was one time before, we did one time again. I think there was, it's nothing in the coming biennium. I just, is my memory right on that to you? I know that the department, I think it was 15 million we wound up with at the end, as I recall. Something like that, anyway.
See if Representative Hundley knows.
Well, I may be wrong, but I thought it was at the end of this year. It's completely gone.
Oh, at the end of the biennium. Yeah, it was always one-time money. The 47 was one time, and then the 10 or 15 was one time.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're both correct.
Okay, wait. Never mind. Through the chair. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
We got the two finance chairs here, or my current and former, and so we got the conversation across the way.
That's
here.
Right.
Okay. Ms. Cleveland. I'm sorry. Representative Hundley.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair and members, let me just explain what that to members is. In my part of the state, there are 4 or 5 counties got together, and about half of the money they got from this they put into helping small businesses do healthy behavior kinds of wellness programs for their employees. And if you look at all the big corporations, every big corporation in the state has a program to help keep their employees healthy. And part of that is because of the good hearts of these chief executives, but a bigger part of it is because these corporations know that it saves them money if their employees are healthy.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the reason that I brought it up is because it had done a great deal of good work out in greater Minnesota. And, of course, we do have the obesity task force that I serve on as well, and I'm concerned about that in my hometown, Faribault, and then the neighboring in Rice County, Northfield. Kids were getting tennis shoes and walking and running and biking and getting outside and doing all kinds of great activities. I'd hate to see all of that end when this ends. And so I hope that we can look at something in the near future.
Okay, let's proceed.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm going to talk about slide 116. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program has approximately 670 individuals currently committed to secure treatment facilities to receive treatment as a sexually dangerous person or an individual with a sexual psychopathic personality. Generally, these are individuals who have served their prison sentence, and as they are approaching their release date, they are reviewed by a panel, and recommendations are made to the county attorney of the county in which they reside or the county in which the offense occurs to determine whether a petition should be filed with the court in that county to commit them to one of the two secure treatment facilities operated by the Department of Human Services. There are two facilities, one in Moose Lake and one in St. Peter. In August of last year, the federal court ordered DHS, based on a lawsuit filed on behalf of some of the clients in the program, the commissioner was ordered to convene a task force to recommend changes to the current treatment program. The first recommendations of the task force were released in early December and dealt with options and less restrictive alternatives to secure treatment. I believe Representatives Abler and Liebling are on that task force.
Right, and Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair, to that point, also I would like to raise the issue of my county, Rice County, is paying more now for the client that are receiving care in the state of Minnesota. I think in the last year in the budget, that's to find money, we were forced, the counties, to pay quite a considerable amount of money now towards the care of the client if they're from that county. So all of us are paying a lot more. My county commissioners brought this to me and ask that we take a look at that. We can't afford that at all, and that's a mandate that's been pushed down on the counties. And so the money that's paying for these folks is also coming from the counties, a considerable amount more than we had in the past, and that's just from the last budget. So you should ask your county commissioners about it.
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, I realize that this may be a completely separate topic, but and either Representative Abler or you, ma'am, how much more work is to be done? I know that this is a pretty significant topic. Well, and as far as the task force goes and what's left in it.
Representative Abler, you want to answer that?
Well, I'll start and you can finish. Actually, a lot. Just to be brief, this has to get done today, so I don't want to take much time on this, but just to be very superficial on this, this is a really, really hard problem. We did increase the rate of county share from 10 to 25%. That was my idea. I admit that. Well, it wasn't to save money. It was an effort. We did get a little bit of savings out of it, but the point wasn't to generate savings, but it was my idea as a way to generate more thought on the part of the counties before they just ship these folks off to incarcerate them. Unfortunately, there's a geographic disparity in how they're committed. Hennepin and Ramsey counties commit the least. The donut counties have the middle number, and the L South and West had the highest level of incarceration. And there's a whole auditor's report, which is fascinating. There's a class action lawsuit by some of their clients. They're not inmates. They paid their time, and now they're deemed to be dangerous and hopefully being rehabilitated. And so where to put them? Some are developmentally disabled. Some are never even convicted, but they're deemed dangerous. And it's a really, really hard problem. And hopefully there'll be some legislation coming forward, which will be deeply discussed in this committee. And Chair Liebling and I are there. But it's a pretty hot topic, and it's a dangerous topic politically, but it's a really important one on a policy basis.
Yeah, and I would just add to that that, you know, for those of you who are here to solve problems, we've got one for you. And we're all going to it's being forced upon us to grapple with it because of the federal lawsuit, and this is something that every legislature for a while has kind of pushed down the road, and we're kind of at the point where we really can't. You know, for those of you who don't like the idea of the feds stepping in and telling us what to do, well, here's one where the feds may very well step in and tell us what to do if we don't decide what to do ourselves. But the only other thing I want to add, because this is a huge topic, and you're all welcome to come to the next task force meeting, which they're being held here, I think, in this very room.
Tuesday night, Madam Chair, I think. Tuesday night, I think.
That may be. I don't have it right in front of me. But very interesting to come to the task force and listen. But I just want to say the reason this is in this committee, you know, you might think this would be a corrections issue and would be more in the public safety area, because indeed it does cross that area. It is also very much about public safety, but because these are people who are not serving a sentence, they're being held for treatment. That is why they're under the purview of DHS and therefore very much before this committee. So it's a bit of an oddity, but in terms of the other work of this committee, but it really is our problem as a committee and, of course, as a legislature. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, as representing the people who will probably see a lot of the people that come out of this, if ever they come out, is there something being done? I know you're studying it a lot, but is there anything being done to seriously get at all of the necessary things for a proper reentry of this population?
Well, Representative Mullery, I guess, I mean, the program itself does have plans of how to get people reentered and so on. As you know, almost none have been reentered, and it's a multifaceted problem. It's a problem of facilities. It's a problem of the courts decide who goes in and who comes out. It's a problem. It's just a multifaceted problem. We don't have time to deal with it today, but we're gonna. Believe me, we're gonna hear more about it, one way or another. And whether something is done, of course, depends on whether legislation's filed and what's in it and what happens to it, just like so many other problems. So we'll look forward to having your participation in that. We've got Huntley and then Grunhagen.
Well, for the members, Madam Chair, this is a hugely controversial issue, and the real problem is they've served their sentence, so they're no longer in prison, and now they're put in a what's supposed to be a medical institution for treatment. But there's no evidence that there is any treatment that works that are given to these people, and so we're under these court orders to do certain things, and so there will be a bill this year, and we'll be looking for a chief author.
Only the courageous may apply. I'm Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just send out an email about that meeting, if it's Tuesday night or whatever?
Well, Representative Grunhagen, the task force itself sends out the meetings. Okay. This isn't really under my... I'm a member of it, and Representative Abler and Senator Lori and Senator Limmer are also members appointed by DHS under orders of the federal court. Okay. So it's not really a legislative committee at all. It's a task force established.
I was just wondering on the time. He thought it was Tuesday.
And Madam Chair, it is next Tuesday from 6 to 9 in one of these rooms in the SOB.
And,
okay. And the public is welcome, and you're welcome to come as a legislator. The more the merrier, frankly, to watch the process and try to figure out how to solve it.
Right. Thank you, Representative Abler. We will send out a notice to the committee members. We'll get the copy of the notice and make sure that everybody gets it. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay, I think we can continue.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to close this part of the presentation with pointing out on slide 117, our names and phone numbers are included in your packet. I know we've given a lot of information over the past 2 days, and if you have any questions about any of the subjects that we have discussed or any related areas that you would like to discuss, please feel free to call us, and we will be happy to talk with you and provide you with the information that you request.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Aves. And I see Ms. Pugnelli is there to do the next section. And is it yours now till the end here?
Madam Chair, Danielle Pugnelli from House Research. I'm here to go over the long-term care portion of it, and then Mr. Chun will do managed care to close it out.
Okay, thank you. We've got 15 more minutes, so we'll try to see if we can get through here.
Madam Chair, these next two topics that we're going to be talking about, long-term care and then managed care, were two topics that you had asked us to pull out and go over as sort of special topics, so that's what we're doing here today. Long-term care services are available to the elderly and persons with disabilities through MA and other state programs. And in order to be eligible for full coverage of MA services as elderly, a person must be age 65 or older, meet income and asset standards, meet requirements related to citizenship and residency, and meet other program eligibility requirements. And I just want to point out that House Research does have a publication, Long-Term Care Services for the Elderly, that has a lot more information about the services and programs for the elderly, in order to qualify as disabled, a person must satisfy the disability criteria that's used by the Federal Social Security Administration or a state medical review team. Common eligibility pathways in Minnesota for persons with disabilities include being blind or disabled, being a child who is disabled, being eligible under the Federal Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982, which is commonly referred to as TEFRA, and this is an optional eligibility category where only the child's income is counted when determining eligibility, and then the parents pay a parental fee based on their adjusted gross income. And then another common eligibility pathway is being an employed person with disabilities, which is called the MAEPD program. and that's also another optional category. Federal law provides an exception from the prohibition on substantial gainful activity for MA eligibility, and it allows persons with disabilities to work productively and still retain health benefits. And under this option, there's no income limit, and the asset limit is $20,000. The MA benefit package covers standard services such as physician, inpatient hospital, dental, therapy, and prescription drugs. MA also covers many services that are used heavily by the elderly and disabled, including nursing facility services, home health care, home and community-based waiver services, and case management services. First, I'm going to just really briefly go through the long-term care institutional care, which is basically nursing facility care, and the intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities. In order to receive nursing facility care, a person must be screened by a long-term care consultation team and be determined by the team to need nursing facility level care. And then the screening team assigns each nursing facility resident one of 48 case mix classifications that reflect the varying care needs of residents. Under MA, nursing facilities are a package of room and board and nursing services, and then nursing facilities are reimbursed by MA on a resident per day basis, and that's adjusted under the case mix system. And then the ICFDDs, a person must have a developmental disability or related condition, require a 24-hour plan of care, require active treatment, and request ICFDD services. The services are a pre-designed package, including room and board, services during the day, and active treatment and transportation. And in Minnesota, the state contracts for these services and sets rates for each facility. Next, I'll talk briefly just about home care. Home care provides medical and health-related services and assistance with day-to-day activities to people in their homes. Home care can be used to provide short-term care for people moving from a hospital or a nursing home back to their home, and it can also be used to provide continuing care to people with ongoing needs. Home care services provided to MA enrollees must be medically necessary, ordered by a licensed physician, documented in a written service plan, provided at the recipient's residence, and provided by a Medicare-certified agency. And some of the home care services include things like intermittent home health aid visits, PCA services, which is personal care assistance, private duty nursing, therapies, intermittent skilled nurse visits, and equipment and supplies. Next, I'll go on to the long-term care MA waivered services. This is something that was initially created back in the 1980s as a way for the Medicaid program to pay for long-term care, home and community-based care, rather than what had been done in the past, which was basically only institutional care. Mm-hmm. So basically what these services cover are services that are necessary to avoid institutionalization that are not offered in Minnesota's MA state plan, or services that are extensions of Minnesota's MA state plan services. And here in Minnesota, we have 5 home and community-based waivered services, and those are the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, the CADI waiver, which provides services for individuals with disabilities who need the level of care provided in a nursing home. Next is the Developmental Disabilities, or DD waiver, which provides services for individuals with developmental disabilities or related conditions who need the same level of care as provided in an ICFDD. Next is the Community Alternatives for Chronically Ill Individuals, the CAC waiver, which provides services for individuals with chronic illness who need the level of care provided in a hospital. And then there's the brain injury waiver, which provides services for individuals with brain injury who need the level of care provided in a nursing home or a neurobehavioral hospital. And then finally, there's the elderly waiver, which provides services to MA enrollees who are at risk of nursing home placement. And I'll just point out that I also have a publication that's an overview of programs for people with disabilities that has a lot more information about this in there.
And Ms. Benili, let me just add for members, I mean, this confused me for a long time, and you're going to hear these acronyms that are on this page, you're going to hear those a lot. People kind of toss them around. Mm-hmm. And the term waiver itself, it gets tossed around. And when I first was elected, I said, what waiver? What is being waived? Because that term gets used as a name for these programs, a waiver. And basically, I think what Ms. Pugnelli's just explained is what that means is that it's an exception or a waiver from the normal medical assistance program. So, you know, I guess we shouldn't get too hung up on the waiver piece of it. It's just what are the different programs, what do they provide and to whom?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. The state has to apply to CMS to receive a waiver, and then they also have to submit a state plan periodically for the waivers to continue to receive federal approval for that.
Representative Hundley.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, first of all, the state determines that this person is eligible to be put into a nursing home. And that's what the feds normally, the normal part of their budget is that they would pay, their half for these people. But we have come up with ways, and the feds have to approve this, to say, well, you know, this person could stay in their own home if they got such and such and such and such. And that's what these waivers, they're a waiver from the federal law about putting people in nursing homes so that we don't have to put them in nursing homes. And in general, they get better care. Most people want to stay in their own home, and it saves us and the feds money.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. I've also got Representative Fritz. I just want to say we've got only five more minutes, and I'm the worst offender by making you stop, but go ahead, Representative
Fritz. I'll be very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there are not enough waivers, and there are lists and people waiting for waivers. So I wanted people to know that these aren't just being handed out willy-nilly because you can't get them. Many people who need them are unable to get them for 8 to 10 years. They've been waiting on the list.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Okay, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move on to the next slide, slide 125. A person must meet all of the following conditions to be eligible for one of the four disability waivers, and those conditions are be under age 65, be certified disabled, choose home and community-based services, meet the MA income and asset requirements, have a plan of care that ensures safety, and have anticipated costs through the waiver program that do not exceed the cost of services that would be provided in an institution or a healthcare facility. And this is a federal requirement that I think is typically referred to as cost neutrality. And then they need to meet all other program requirements. In order to receive elderly waiver services, a person must be age 65 or older, need nursing facility level care as determined by the long-term care consultation process, choose community care, and meet the elderly waiver income standard, which is different than the typical MA program standard. The services that are available through the home and community-based waiver services include things like assisted living, extended home care services, chore companion and homemaker services, licensed community residential services, environmental accessibility adaptations, and transportation. Some of the state programs that Minnesota has for supporting the elderly and disabled include the group residential housing program, which we talked about yesterday, long-term care consultation services, alternative care, family support grants, consumer support grants, and semi-independent living services. And then the final slide that I have on long-term care, this is, for those of you that were in Representative Huntley's committee this morning, this is kind of a different depiction of one of the pie charts, actually two pie charts that were side-by-side that Commissioner Jessen had, that just shows the contrast within the MA program by category of the enrollment versus expenditures on the different categories within MA. So you can see, for example, the disabled make up about 17% of MA enrollment, but they used about 45% of the funding.
Yeah, thank you. And Mr. Chun, if it would be okay with you, maybe we would pause here and pick up your next section, which is pretty distinct, and we'll do that in a future meeting because we don't really have time to do it justice right now. And so I just really want to thank all our four House researchers for doing this. I did push them quite a bit out of their comfort zone. You don't often see them presenting from the front table, but you know, we really appreciate it. I think, members, I really suggest that you keep this, what you've gotten here, because it really, you won't see the things laid out this way very often, and I think it's been extremely helpful, and I hope you do too, and I'd love to get your feedback too, individually. So, Representative Huntley.
Yeah, I would just say that that 129 slide is dynamite. I mean, yeah. To really understanding where we spend our money, keep that one, cut it out, post it on your door.
Thank you, Representative Huffley. I think it would be good, you know, to hang on to this. You might even want to keep it in your folder for future reference. And with that, members, thank you. We're adjourned.